Greetings from the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts, and serving the Cape, the Islands, and the South Coast. The Ledger delivers information and entertainment to the print impaired from our Cape-based volunteer readers, as well as from other services around the state, such as the Talking Information Center in Marshfield and the Audio Journal in Worcester. You may sometimes hear their content, but it's the Cape's very own Audible Local Ledger that is broadcasting it. My name is Caroline, and this week I'll be reading selections surrounding the theme of Christmas memories. My first selection is The Long Christmas Eve, a story written by Elizabeth Durya, and it was a childhood favorite as it takes place on Beacon Hill in Boston. For the twins, Maria and Carl, Christmas Eve on Beacon Hill was full of voices. The talking voices of people moving up and down the steep, narrow streets, calling out greetings to one another. The singing voices of groups of carolers, stopping before candlelit windows and bright doorways to sing. The voices of bells in the steeples and towers of churches. It was the high moment of the year. The twins had lived on Beacon Hill in Boston all their lives, nearly 12 years, and had come to think of themselves as belonging there as completely as the children whose families had lived in the neighborhood for generations. But their father and mother did not feel the same way. They had not been born in America, but had come that year they were married from Oberammergau, the beautiful mountain village in the Bavarian Alps. They were Americans now and full of a deep love for their new country, but they never let Maria and Carl, or even 3-year-old Tony, forget that they had brought with them many age-old customs that had been observed in their family for generations. Christmas was the time when they recalled such things especially. They tried to combine the way they had been brought up to celebrate it with the new customs they had learned in America. The twins thought that no family on Beacon Hill had so wonderful a Christmas as theirs. They always set up their creche on the afternoon of Christmas Eve when they trimmed the tree. This creche had come from Oberammergau and was particularly precious because most of the figures had been carved by the twins' own grandfather. It had been a farewell present when Lisa and Bartle had set out to establish home in a new land. One of the lambs and a shepherd had been made by Bartle himself, who, like many Oberammergau boys, had been taught to carve by his father. They put the wide, low manger with a thatched roof in the bay window, which jutted out over the sidewalk at the right of the front door. It was lighted with small, cleverly hidden spotlights, and behind it hung a dark blue velvet curtain. The custom had grown up in the last few years for Bartle and the twins, all wearing red woolen caps and scarves and mittens, which the children's grandmother in Oberammergau had knitted, to go out with the creche and tree, to go out when the creche and tree were finished and do the rounds of the streets. Tony was still too young to go, and Mother was usually glad to have a chance to do some secret last-minute things when nobody was around. The route was always the same, up and down each side of Chestnut Street, where they lived, and then Mount Vernon Street and Pinckney Street, and around the little iron-fenced park in Louisburg Square. On these streets, almost all the houses stood close to the sidewalks, and often the creches in the windows would come exactly at the level of Maria and Carl's eyes. Some were even so low that a small child, without standing on tiptoe, could see the figures inside. This year, it had snowed all the day before and part of that morning, but now a clear, starlit sky stretched above the steep streets, and the air was sharp as Father and the twins set off up the hill. Best of all, one's feet crunched. That was the most delicious sounds in the world. The expedition always ended with their going down to Charles Street and walking up one side and back on the other. Sometimes there were small errands to be done, but chiefly it was window shopping that they did, spending all the time they wanted to before each brightly lighted window. There were florist shops displaying masses of brilliant red poinsettias, antique shops with old china and brass and glass and furniture, bookshops, greeting card shops, a tiny grocery where they knew the old-fashioned smell of because they often did errands there, places to eat where people sat at little tables, those near the windows looking out indifferently at passerbys who looked in curiously at them. Once in a while, they stopped before a window that had nothing in it to catch their attention. Then for a minute, they stood looking at themselves reflected in the glass. It always amused the twins to look at themselves or each other in a mirror. They both had the same color hair, light, almost golden, the same color eyes, blue-gray, the same color of skin, fair that glowed with good health, especially on cold winter days like this one. Maria wore her hair in long braids tied with ribbons, red today. Carl's hair barely showed at all under his knitted cap. "When I look at us in a glass like this," Maria said, "I'm glad you weren't a girl. I wouldn't know whether it was myself looking at you or you looking at me." "Oh, come along," Carl urged. "I'm frozen, aren't you? Let's go into Miss Abbott's gift shop and get the paper and ribbon we need." The gift shop was a tiny, crowded place with small tables jumbled together, covered with the usual variety of gifts, Christmas cards, fancy wrapping paper, and ribbon. "I'll look around while you buy what you want," Father said, moving to the back of the shop. When the twins were ready to leave, he was still there, looking down at something he held in his hand. He did not move when Maria called him. Miss Abbott, who knew him, went over to him. "Can I help you, Mr. Bayer?" He started and looked up at her vaguely, as though his mind had to come back from a long distance. He held out his hand, and the children moved closer, saw in it a small angel carved out of light, honey-colored wood. With his head thrown back and his right hand on his hip, the angel was blowing a tiny, delicate horn. From his shoulders came out two jaunty, stiff little wings, and his hair was curled in tight curls, amazingly real and lifelike. His rope swung back and curled over at the bottom like small wooden waves about to break. It was not more than 4 inches high and was so exquisitely carved, so full of life and grace and motion, that Maria cried. "Father, how lovely! Where did it come from?" But they knew before he told them. "It was made in Oberammergau. There is a whole orchestra of them. One plays the flute, another a violin, another a drum and cymbals, another cello, another holds a roll of music and is singing, another has a tiny baton, and so on." "Yes," Miss Abbott said, "I had them all, but people loved them, and I sold them fast. All but this one, and I liked this best of all. I can't think how it ever got left." "Oh, can we buy it?" Maria said. "We ought to have it for our creche." Father turned the angel slowly in his expert fingers that knew so well the feel of wood. He shook his head. "I don't need even to ask the price to know it is too expensive. Such things are real works of art made by carvers who have had years of training and experience. It is like a beautiful statue or a painting. I am glad there are people who can afford to buy them, or no one would make them. But, well, teachers' families have to be contented with just admiring and appreciating them." Miss Abbott took out a little cardboard box from under a shelf and looked at the price on the bottom. "It's so late now, Mr. Bayer, I don't think anyone is going to buy it. It was $6.50, but if you want it, and I don't know any home where it would be happier than in yours, you may have it for $5. She tactfully walked away to give them a chance to think about this. He stood there, not turning the figure anymore, but holding it absently and looking away. The twins knew perfectly well where his thoughts had gone. So often they had seen pictures of Oberammergau and heard stories of their parents' childhood that it was all as familiar to them as though they had themselves once lived in that high alpine village. They knew he would be thinking of it as he would look on the winter evening like this. He would be skiing home from school at the ancient cloister nearby. The mountains black with forests rose on either side to the clear sky, and ahead of him the white road followed the noisy river. The village was still hidden behind the curious rocky peak, which people called the Kofel. But now, as the road turned, he would see the onion-shaped top on the church tower, and then the lights in the houses would appear, glowing yellow and warm through the dusk. Here was the inn, brightly lighted, with music coming forth when the door was opened. Here were the shops, the shoemaker, the druggist, the grocer, but best of all, the woodcarvers. In one of these last shops, Bartle had spent long and happy hours as a boy learning to carve beside his father, a master carver. Carl watched his father standing there lost in memories and thought to himself, no matter how good an American father is, there'll always be a homesick place deep down inside of him that he'll never get rid of. Suddenly, a little unexpected smile broke over his father's face. For a moment, he looked almost mischievous, and both Maria and Carl expected him to reach for the cardboard box, lay the angel in it gently, and say, I'll take it. Instead, to their keen disappointment, he put the figure back on the little hanging shelf where he had found it and turned away. But Father, Maria protested. Father shook his head. He will blow his horn just as loudly, and it will sound just as sweet in an American creche as in one that was made in Oberammergau. But he may not get the chance to, Carl said. He may just stand there on the shelf all through Christmas, and no one will hear him at all. Father turned this over thoughtfully in his mind. There must be many beautiful things that exist just for beauty's sake, with no one to notice or hear them. All the angels' songs are not heard by human ears. So let's go now. Your mother will be wondering where we are. There was a subdued feeling about the walk home. Which one of them thought of it first, nobody will ever know. Carl said it came to him like a flash, just as they opened the front door, and Mother called out, where in the world have you been? You've been gone for hours and hours. Maria said it came to her as she stopped on their front steps to look in at their creche in the bay window. She knew instantly that her father must have that Christmas angel. As it had happened again and again between them, the twins knew what was in their minds before a word was spoken. They reached up at the same moment to put on the light in the closet under the stairs where they hung their coats and hats. And as they looked at each other under the light, each saw it in the other's eyes. Stealthily, they closed the door behind them and began making their plans. Father was still upstairs taking off his things, the twins supposed, as they went down to the basement kitchen to look for Mother. She was there feeding Tony his supper. Mother, Carl whispered, we must speak to you right away. Is Tony almost through? Tony had big ears. He heard everything, especially what he was not supposed to hear, and he could not keep a secret. Then, said Carl, let Maria watch him and come into the hall. I must ask you something right away. This was expecting too much of Maria, as her mother saw it once. He's all right for a moment. We'll all go. Behind the kitchen, there was a little coal closet which Mrs. Bayer used as a storeroom. Into this, they all three huddled and closed the door tight. Then both began walking, talking at once. The twins told Mother about the angel. She was so used to having them tell her things this way that she always managed to piece together whatever they said and make a coherent story out of it. So couldn't we take the money out of our banks and get it for him, Mother? Couldn't we run down right now before Miss Abbott closes her shop and buy it? Couldn't you put it into the creche after Father goes to bed so he'll see it when we open the door in the morning? If you'd ever seen the expression on his face, Mother, you'd see we have to buy it for him. He just stood there holding it. and Miss Abbott marked it down when she found out he was so taken with it, but he said, "And Mother, he looked for a moment so homesick. If you only knew." "I know," she said. "I know. It's Christmas for me, too." They were all silent then for a moment. "You know, Mother," Maria said, "how hard it is to ever find anything Father really wants. He'll never give us so much as a hint, though he's always looking out for something he thinks we have our hearts set on. Now's our chance." Lisa laughed. "Two of you at once is pretty overpowering, but you needn't work so hard to persuade me. I should be just as glad as you to find something Father would like. Only couldn't you let me in on it, too? Couldn't we all three dig into our banks and pool our resources?" And so it was decided, and the plot worked out. The twins went upstairs to the first floor, and after a moment, Lisa called out, "How about the cherries I needed for my pudding? Did you remember to get them?" And the twins called back, "Oh, Mother, weren't we stupid? But Father kept looking into so many windows, we entirely forgot about them. We'll run right down and get them." Then to their horror, Father said, "Did we forget something?" He came out of the dark living room where, for some reason, he had been sitting with his coat still on, and his hat and mittens and scarf held in his hands. "I'll go back and get it," he offered. "I still have my things on." The twins gave a gasp and looked at Mother. But she was equal to the occasion. "I wouldn't trust you. You look in all the windows you missed before, and you'd not get back for hours. Besides, I'm counting on you to give Tony his bath and put him to bed while I get the supper on the table. Please go down and look after him. He's eating scrambled egg, and he'll have it in his hair by now. I'll just find my pocketbook." "Well, how much do you need?" Father asked, pulling out his purse. "Here." Mother calmly took out a quarter and gave him back the purse. Then she gave him a gentle little shove toward the kitchen stairs, and at last they got rid of him. The banks were square wooden boxes with slots in the top, painted in bright designs, each with a different basic color. The twins kept theirs in their own rooms, and Mother's was hidden no one knew where. It was only a matter of moments for them to accumulate the $5. Carl put it into his pocketbook deliberately while Maria hurried him along, saying, "If we get there and the shop is closed, think how we'll feel then." But their mother reassured them. "It probably isn't 5:30 yet. It gets dark so early these winter days, you'd think it's later than it is. Let's see." She looked at her wristwatch. "Oh, yes, it's nearly 6:15. You will have to hurry." She helped them into their coats, tossed them their hats and mittens and scarves, and opened the front door. The cold air bit into their lungs as the twins ran. It hurt deep down and pulled them to a walk. "You go ahead," Maria panted. "I simply can't run in this cold. Go as fast as you can. I'll catch up with you." But Carl beat her by only a minute and had hardly closed the door of the shop behind him when she opened it. Miss Abbott looked up from her desk where she was doing accounts. When she saw them, she smiled slyly, reached over and picked up from her desk a small package, already wrapped, and held it out to them. "Oh, but how did you know?" Maria began. "I knew. I worked it all out in my mind, just what you would do. I probably had it done up before you got the idea of coming back for it, after you had seen your father standing there holding it. Well, there wasn't anything else you could do, was there?" Carl looked thoughtful. "You didn't think maybe Father would come back and buy it for us, did you?" he said. Miss Abbott hesitated. "What I thought was that the angel had been left unsold in my shop so that I could spend Christmas where it belonged, and that was in your home. I didn't know just how it was going to get there, but I felt perfectly sure it would." The twins were silent. There was something a little frightening about a person, even a person like mousy Miss Abbott with her thin, soft voice and faded eyes, who could foretell the future so accurately. They gave her the money respectfully. "If you walk by our house tomorrow night, you can see how it looks in the creche," Maria suggested. Miss Abbott thanked them, wished them a Merry Christmas, and they left the shop with the precious box held tightly in Carl's hand. There was no hurry now. They walked carefully, sedately, thinking of the moment tomorrow morning when Father's glance would first fall on the new figure in the creche, and his eyes grow wide with surprise. Father may say he thinks the angel's horn would sound as clear and sweet in an American creche, but when the angel finds himself in a whole crowd of Oberammergau carvings, won't he just throw back his head and blow? Maria had no idea how long she had been asleep when a sound from the basement kitchen, two floors below, wakened her. One step at a time, she went slowly down till she could see into the brightly lighted kitchen beyond the door at the foot of the stairs. There, in the middle of the blue floor, with all the furniture pushed back out of the way, were her father and mother dancing. Bartle was wearing his leather trousers and embroidered suspenders, and Lisa, her dirndl with its bright green skirt and white blouse with short puff sleeves. They were doing one of the old dances they had learned in Oberammergau, and were trying to sing and yodel and laugh all at once without making too much noise. It was only a minute before they stopped, breathless, and Lisa dropped into a straight kitchen chair. "Oh, it's too late to dance like that," she gasped. "I can't take another step." "Oh, it's never too late to dance," Bartle laughed. "But I guess even this night is over, and we must get to bed." In a few moments, she heard soft footsteps going past her door, and the door of her parents' room close. Then, for a long time, there was silence. Now she really worried. Mother, for once, had slipped up. She went out into the hall and stood there, troubled and undecided what to do. If the angel were not in the creche when they all trooped in the morning, the pleasure of surprising Father would be lost. She sat down on the top stair and considered the situation. But after a minute or two, she began to feel cold and had just started to go back to bed when she heard her mother's door open softly. She stepped into her room just in time to get out of the way as her mother moved along the dark hall, past her, and down the stairs. A sense of comfort and relief swept over her. She went back to bed, thinking how surprised the other figures in the creche must be feeling at that moment to have the new little angel come into their midst this Christmas Eve, blowing his horn, and she went to sleep with her mind at ease. It was Tony who woke the family the next morning. Bartle, Lisa, and Maria had been up so late the night before, they would probably have gone right on sleeping till noon, and Carl never woke up until somebody called him. But Tony was an early riser, and today his high little voice began singing away in a manger long before the first sign of daylight appeared. Actually, it was not so early as it seemed, because the days at this season were short, and it took some time for the sun to reach the narrow streets on Beacon Hill. Once they really had waked up and the wheels of their sleepy brains had begun to turn, the other members of the household jumped out of bed and put on their slippers and bathrobes, joining Tony in singing one carol after another, filling in the words he could not remember. It was a rule that everybody must have some breakfast or at least a warm drink before the family assembled outside the living room door. This always proved to be a disorganized and noisy meal, with the whole family rushing around the kitchen and getting into one another's way. The table was not set because the children were too excited to sit down, and for once Lisa had Bartle, and Bartle made no effort to keep them quiet. There was cocoa in the heavy blue mugs, each of which was decorated with an amusing drawing of an animal, a cow or a horse or a pig. There was a special kind of Christmas bread with fruits and nuts in it that Lisa's mother had taught her to make when she was a girl. Tony was underfoot everywhere, dropping crumbs on the blue floor. Bartle looked tired and had deep shadows under his eyes, but seemed as lively and excited as the rest of them. Perhaps more so. And, at last, even Tony had tipped his mug up far enough to see "The End" written inside on the bottom of it, and the whole loaf of Christmas bread had vanished, except for what had crumbled on the floor. They gathered, as they had done as far back as the children could remember, at the foot of the basement stairs, and mother in her full, rich voice began singing O Tannenbaum. Then they went up the stairs slowly. The hall had been left dark on purpose to afford a contrast with the brightly lighted room they were about to enter. Mother had to help Tony find the way. In their excitement, the twins forgot to keep on singing, but stood holding each other's hands tightly. For the first time in their lives, it never occurred to them to wonder what would be in the presence waiting for them under the tree. Then, in the middle of a line, Father stopped singing too, and Mother had to finish out all the words alone because Tony did not know the carol all the way to the end. It had always been the custom for Mother to slip into the living room at this moment and turn the lights on in the creche and on the Christmas tree. She said this privilege made up for her for missing the shopping expedition's Christmas Eve. As soon as she had finished the carol, Lisa turned the handle of the door, pushed it open just far enough to let herself through, and disappeared into the dark room. She was gone only a minute and then was back with them again, but they always felt the same, that some of the brilliance from within hung about her after she came out. Even in the dimly lit hall, her eyes seemed to reflect the bright vision of what she had looked upon. Finally, it was Father's privilege to open the door and usher the family into the magic room. He had never seemed so impatient for this moment as he was today, and it was only a second after Mother came out before he had thrown the door open and stepped in. They all followed him, and then a strange thing happened. Usually there was a quiet hush while the eyes of the little group passed slowly about the room, taking in the tall silvery tree with its familiar ornaments, the presents done up in gay wrappings lying beneath it, and over at one side, under a hidden floodlight that fell full on the tiny carved figures, the Oberammergau manger. It was always the same and always different, but the breathtaking beauty of the room never failed to hold them there speechless for a few moments. Only Mother noticed what was happening today. During these silent moments, nobody was looking at the room at all. The twins stood there, holding each other tightly by the hand and looking at Father. Bartel stood there, not even so much as glancing at the room, but looking at the twins. And Lisa, holding her breath, was watching the whole scene, caught up and lost in their suppressed excitement. It was Tony who broke the spell with a sharp squeal of astonishment. "Look, Mummy! Father, look! The angels!" He ran to the manger, and in a second would have had a precious angel in his hand if Mother had not caught him in time. But almost before she got there, they were all down on their knees looking at the manger. There on either side of the usual figures of Mary and Joseph, the baby, the wise men, the shepherds, and the animals, were two angels carved out of pale honey-colored wood. One was playing a horn with all his tiny might, his robe swaying about him, his wings standing jauntily out behind. And on the opposite side was an angel exactly the same size and color, playing an accordion. His head was bent forward and a little sideways, so that her wings stood up stiffly behind it, and her body seemed to sway and bend with the music. Her arms were thrown wide apart, and they might stretch the accordion to its fullest length. There was motion and rhythm in every fold and curve of the wood. The face, surrounded with a tight, pointed little curls like those of the other angel, was intensely occupied with drawing out from the many folds of the accordion gay, lilting music as an offering to the Christ child. And the queer thing now that Mother noticed was that Father forgot all about the twins, and the twins forgot all about him. Each was absorbed in an amazed contemplation of the angel he had never seen before. Carl picked up the accordion angel and turned it about slowly, while Maria knelt beside him watching. It was Maria with her quick mind that so often knew things before she had really had time to think them through, who guessed where it had come from. "Father, you made it!" Then Mother spoke. "I thought nobody was ever going to say anything. Here I have kept secrets for the whole family all night long, and have hardly been able to stand it till you could come in here and find out about them. And then, when you do, nobody says a word." But Mother did not have to wait any longer. Everyone began asking questions at once. How Bartle wanted to know, could the Horn Angel have gotten out of the shop when it was so late the day before, when they had been there, and who had bought it, and whose present was it to whom? And how Carl wanted to know, had Father known how to make the accordion angel, and what size to make it, and had he already made it before they went to the shop? And why had he stood in the shop holding the Horn Angel so long in his hand? Maria asked. Was he comparing it with the one he had made himself? And how in the world, Father insisted on knowing, had they got their angel into the creche without seeing his angel there? For that matter, how did he get his there? Maria wondered. And Tony kept saying, show them to me. Let me see the angels. What's that the angel is pulling out? What does it do? Then Mother wished for the silence she had complained about. Would they never stop asking questions and give her a chance? For it was Mother, and the only mother, and only Mother, who could straighten the whole mystery, all the two mysteries, out. It was lucky that the family had learned the habit of listening to Mother when she spoke, or the questions might have gone on endlessly. Now, when she said in her quiet but empathic way, do keep still, I'll explain everything. Even Tony stopped talking and looked at her. She reached under the tree and found a package that had in it a large book of animal pictures, and Tony settled down on the floor to look at it. Then Mother seated herself in the big chair, and Father and the twins sat on the floor at her ankles, tucking their bathrobes around their bare ankles. She began way back where they had found Father sitting in the living room with his coat still on, and had had so much trouble getting him out of the way so they could go out again. What he had been doing there was thinking about what kind of angel he could make in one night. The idea had come to him while he was holding the angel in his hands at Miss Abbott's shop, turning it round and round and enjoying the good familiar feel of the wood. At first he had just wanted to buy it, even more than the twins had wanted it. Then he began wondering what carver in Oberammergau had made it. It might even have been his father. He was thinking of his father's white head bent over his workbench, when suddenly he remembered his own carving tools packed away in an old chest down in the furnace room, with several small pieces of fine fruit wood he had brought from home. And that set him wondering why he would not carve one of the angels in the orchestra. All the way home he had thought about it. Of course he knew he would never dare try the one with the horn because it was too delicate. If he spoiled one, there would not be time to do another. But there were other instruments in the orchestra, a drum, a cello, a flute, though they were almost as difficult to carve. Then he had remembered the accordion. That would not be so complicated. As he sat in the living room, forgetting to take off his coat, he began to think how the accordion angel ought to look, its head bent forward, the arms held out wide, the wings pointing upward. He was just going to go upstairs and make a sketch of it when the twins burst in upon him. While they were out doing their errand, Father told Mother his big idea. Now Mother was worrying for fear Miss Abbott's shop might be closed, and at first hardly caught what Father was saying. When she finally got the idea that he intended to make an angel in one night, she said, not meaning to discourage him, "Could you really get it finished?" "I could try," he said. "If I did succeed, no one would be disappointed but me. And if I did..." His fingers were itching to get hold of his carving tools and begin. But first there had to be supper, and Tony had to be put to bed. He was excited and kept getting out of bed again, and the twins kept running all over the house, thinking of one more present to tie up. It seemed to Father that they would never get safely out of the way, so he could pull the kitchen table out under the big overhead light and get to work. But at last, the house was quiet. While Father intently worked in the kitchen, Mother finished all sorts of little jobs she had left till the children were asleep, and then carried the presents into the living room and put them under the tree. When she went down to the kitchen to see how things were going, Father was nervous. Everything was going wrong. He had made a mistake in his calculations, and he had to take a precious new piece of wood and begin over. Mother took him something to eat now and then, hot coffee, sandwiches, Christmas cookies. He ate what she brought without stopping to think what it was and went on working. Towards midnight, the church bells began ringing for the midnight services, and the music of chimes came clearly through the cold, still air. Father did not talk while he worked, and Mother began to get sleepy. It had been a long, busy day for her. She went upstairs to turn off the lights on the tree and in the creche, and then, enjoying the fragrance of the tree, she sat down in a comfortable chair. She found herself thinking of Omaramago, the processions that wind through the village with a lighted star carried at the head of it, in and out of the narrow, crooked streets, till finally it reaches the great church. The beautiful gold-and-white interior of the church would be ablaze with candlelight and packed so full that many people would have to stand through the service. The village orchestra, with its wind and brass instruments, would make a glorious rising flood of music. Relatives and friends would be there, and afterwards they would all meet outside and stand talking in little groups. The stars would seem very near in the thin mountain air, or perhaps it would be snowing. The next thing Mother knew, Father was pulling her up by both hands, saying, "Come and look at it. It's done and nothing broke. Even the wings are fastened on." They rushed downstairs together. There on the table was the new angel, playing her accordion so hard it seemed as though one could see her head nod and her body bend with the music. It seemed to Mother that no carving she had ever seen, not even the carvings of Madonnas and saints she had known in Omaramago, had been more beautiful than that tiny angel playing her accordion on their kitchen table. Mother loved her the minute she saw her. "She looks so little and alone," she said. "I wonder if she doesn't feel homesick and a bit strange here on Beacon Hill." "Oh, no," Father said. "She wouldn't be homesick. She belongs here." They turned the creche around so that it faced into the room and put the angel on the right side near the front where she could easily be seen. Mother, of course, knew that another angel was going to take his place on the other side, but keeping secrets was one of the things Mother did best. So she only smiled to herself quietly when Father said, "Can't you just see the children's faces when they come in and find her?" "Oh, but Mother," Carl said, interrupting the story, "what I can't see is how you ever got the other angel into the creche without Father knowing it." "Oh, that was the worst part of the whole long night," Mother said. "Before we could go to bed, your father and I went down and swept up every tiny little sliver of wood from the kitchen floor. And they were everywhere. I think he must have tossed them over his shoulders." "Oh, your mother doesn't know it," Father said, "but I pushed a pile of them into the corner and put the wastebasket on top of them." Mother went on, "When we finally got to bed, I simply made myself stay awake till I knew your father was asleep. And then I went down and got the other angel out of the cookie jar where I had hidden him and put him into the creche. I have no idea what time it was when I finally crawled up the stairs for the last time." Maria was just on the point of saying, "I have," but she caught herself in time. "I feel as though two new members have been added to our family," Father said, picking up both angels and holding them in his hands tenderly. "From now on, they will be part of all our Christmases." While we were carrying the horn angel back from the shop, Carl said, "I kept thinking all the way how surprised he was going to be to find himself, all of a sudden, in a manger full of other carvings from Omaramago." "And I," said Maria, "kept thinking how lonesome he would have been all by himself on that shelf in the shop, while the other angels that had been there had gone and were in somebody's home having a happy Christmas." "As I was working on the accordion angel," Father said, "I thought to myself, here, hidden away in this piece of wood, is an angel that never saw Omaramago, just as my children never saw it. But the wood she is made of and the hands that they are carving, her, came from Omaramago. So she is really a special kind of angel, bringing together our old life and our new one. And then it occurred to me that you, our children, are like that. You were born here, and you belong here. But in you is something precious that you must always be proud of, something that your mother and I brought as a gift to America. The little group sat there still for a moment, thinking of how much the two new angels stood for in that household, and how much meaning could be hidden away in a little black block of wood. Then Tony said, "Aren't you ever going to open your presents?" And once again, it was Christmas morning as usual in the Bear family. My next selection is entitled My Christmas Miracle, and it was written by Taylor Caldwell. For many of us, one Christmas stands out from all the others, the one when the meaning of the day shone clearest. Although I did not guess it, my own truest Christmas began on a rainy spring day in the bleakest year of my life. Recently divorced, I was in my 20s, had no job, and was on my way downtown to go the rounds of the employment offices. I had no umbrella, for my old one had fallen apart, and I could not afford another one. I sat down in the streetcar, and there, against the seat, was a beautiful silk umbrella with a silver handle inlaid with gold and flecks of bright enamel. I had never seen anything so lovely. I examined the handle and saw a name engraved among the golden scrolls. The usual procedure would have been to turn in the umbrella to the conductor, but on impulse, I decided to take it with me and find the owner myself. I got off the streetcar in a downpour and thankfully opened the umbrella to protect myself. Then I searched a telephone book for the name on the umbrella and found it. I called, and a lady answered. "Yes," she said in surprise, "that was her umbrella, which her parents, now dead, had given her for a birthday present. But," she added, "it had been stolen from her locker at school," she was a teacher, "more than a year before. She was so excited that I forgot I was looking for a job and went directly to her small house. She took the umbrella, and her eyes filled with tears. The teacher wanted to give me a reward, but though $20 was all I had in the world, her happiness at retrieving this special possession was such that to have accepted money would have spoiled something. We talked for a while, and I must have given her my address. I don't remember. The next 6 months were wretched. I was able to obtain only temporary employment here and there for a small salary, though this was what they now called the Roaring Twenties. But I put aside 25 or 50 cents when I could afford it for my little girl's Christmas presents. It took me 6 months to save $8. My last job ended the day before Christmas. My $30 rent was soon due, and I had $15 to my name, which Peggy and I would need for food. She was home from her convent boarding school and was excitedly looking forward to her gifts the next day, which I had already purchased. I had bought her a small tree, and we were going to decorate it that night. The stormy air was full of the sound of Christmas merriment as I walked from the streetcar to my small apartment. Bells rang and the children shouted in the bitter dusk of the evening, and windows were lighted and everyone was running and laughing. But there would be no Christmas for me, I knew. No gifts, no remembrance whatsoever. As I struggled through the snowdrifts, I just about reached the lowest point in my life. Unless a miracle happened, I would be homeless in January, foodless, jobless. I had prayed steadily for weeks, and there had been no answer but this coldness and darkness, this harsh air, this abandonment. God and men had completely forgotten me. I felt old as death and as lonely. What was to become of us? I looked in my mailbox. There were only bills in it, a sheaf of them, and two white envelopes, which I was sure contained more bills. I went up three dusty flights of stairs, and I cried, shivering in my thin coat. But I made myself smile so I could greet my little daughter with a pretense of happiness. She opened the door for me and threw herself in my arms, screaming joyously and demanding that we decorate the tree immediately. Peggy was not yet 6 years old and had been alone all day while I worked. She had set our kitchen table for our evening meal, proudly, and put pans out and the 3 cans of food which would be our dinner. For some reason, when I looked at those pans and cans, I felt broken-hearted. We would have only hamburgers for our Christmas dinner tomorrow, and gelatin. I stood in the cold little kitchen, and misery overwhelmed me. For the first time in my life, I doubted the existence of God and His mercy, and the coldness in my heart was colder than ice. The doorbell rang, and Peggy ran fleetly to answer it, calling that it must be Santa Claus. Then I heard a man talking heartily to her and went to the door. He was a delivery man, and his arms were full of big parcels, and he was laughing at my child's frenzied joy and her dancing. This is a mistake, I said, but he read the name on the parcels, and they were for me. When he had gone, I could only stare at the boxes. Peggy and I sat on the floor and opened them. A huge doll, 3 times the size of the one I had bought for her. Gloves, candy, a beautiful leather purse. Incredible. I looked for the name of the sender. It was the teacher. The address simply, California, where she had moved. Our dinner that night was the most delicious I had ever eaten. I could only pray in myself, "Thank you, Father." I forgot I had no money for the rent, and only $15 in my purse and no job, but my child and I ate and laughed together in happiness. Then we decorated the little tree and marveled at it. I put Peggy to bed and set up her gifts around the tree, and a sweet peace flooded me like benediction. I had some hope again. I could even examine the sheafs of bills without cringing. Then I opened the 2 white envelopes. One contained a check for $30 from a company I had worked for briefly in the summer. It was, said a note, my Christmas bonus. My rent. The other envelope was an offer of a permanent position with the government to begin 2 days after Christmas. I sat with the letter in my hand and the check on the table before me, and I think that was the most joyful moment of my life up to that time. The church bells began to ring. I hurriedly looked at my child, who was sleeping blissfully, and ran down to the street. Everywhere, people were walking to church to celebrate the birth of the Savior. People smiled at me, and I smiled back. The storm had stopped. The sky was pure and glittering with stars. "The Lord is born," sang the bells to the crystal night and the laughing darkness. Someone began to sing, "Come, all ye faithful." I joined in and sang with the strangers all about me. I am not alone at all, I thought. I was never alone at all. And that, of course, is the message of Christmas. We are never alone. Not when the night is darkest, the wind coldest, the world seemingly most indifferent. For this is still the time God chooses. My final reading today shows a different side of Mark Twain. It is his letter to his daughters. Susie's letter from Santa, and shows certainly just a different perspective than one might normally have of Mark Twain. It is written from the Palace of St. Nicholas in the moon Christmas morning. My dear Susie Clemens, I have received and read all the letters which you and your little sister have written me by the hand of your mother and your nurses. I have also read those which you little people have written me with your own hands, for although you did not use any characters that are in grown people in the grown people's alphabet, You used the characters that all children in all lands on earth and in the twinkling stars use. And as all my subjects in the moon are children and use no characters but that, you will easily understand that I can read your and your baby sister's jagged and fantastic marks without any trouble at all. But I had trouble with those letters which you dictated through your mother and the nurses, for I am a foreigner and cannot read English writing well. You will find that I made no mistakes about the things which you and the baby ordered in your letters. I went down your chimney at midnight when you were asleep and delivered them all myself, and kissed both of you too, because you are good children, well trained, nice mannered, and about the most obedient little people I ever saw. But in the letter which you dictated, there were some words which I could not make out for certain, and one or two small orders which I could not fill because we ran out of stock. Our last lot of kitchen furniture for dolls has just gone to a very poor little child in the North Star, away up in the cold country, above the Big Dipper. Your mama can show you that star, and you will say, "Little Snowflake," for that is the child's name. I'm glad you got that furniture, for you need it more than I. That is, you must write that with your own hand. And Snowflake will write you an answer. If you only spoke it, she wouldn't hear you. Make your letter light and thin, for the distance is great and the postage very heavy. There was a word or two in your mama's letter which I couldn't be certain of. I took it to be a trunk full of doll's clothes. Is that it? I will call at your kitchen door about 9 o'clock this morning to inquire. But I must not see anybody, and I must not speak to anybody but you. When the kitchen doorbell rings, George must be blindfolded and sent to open the door. Then he must go back to the dining room or the china closet and take the cook with him. You must tell George he must walk on tiptoe and not speak. Then you must go up the nursery and stand on a chair or the nurse's bed and put your ear to the speaking tube that leads down to the kitchen. And when I whistle through it, you must speak in the tube and say, "Welcome, Santa Claus." Then I will ask whether it was a trunk you ordered or not. If you say it was, I shall ask you what color you want the trunk to be. Your mama will help you to name a nice color. And then you must tell me every single thing in detail which you want the trunk to contain. Then when I say, "Goodbye and a Merry Christmas to my little Susie Clemens," you must say, "Goodbye, old Santa Claus. I thank you very much, and please tell that little snowflake I will look at her star tonight, and she must look down here. I will be right in the West Bay window, and every fine night, I will look at her star and say, 'I know somebody up there and like her too.'" Then you must go down into the library and make George close the doors that open into the main hall, and everybody must keep still for a little while. Then while you are waiting, I will go to the moon and get those things. And in a few minutes, I will come down the chimney that belongs to the fireplace that is in the hall. If it is a trunk you want, because I couldn't get such a large thing as a trunk down the nursery chimney, you know. People may talk if they want, till they hear my footsteps in the hall. Then you tell them to keep quiet a little while, until I go up the chimney. Maybe you will not hear my footsteps at all. So you may go now and then, peep through the dining room doors, and by, you will see that which you want right under the piano in the drawing room, for I shall put it there. If I should leave any snow in the hall, you must tell George to sweep it into the fireplace, for I haven't time to do such things. George must not use a broom, but a rag. You watch George and don't let him run into danger. If my boot should leave a stain on the marble, George must not wholly stone it away. Leave it there always in memory of my visit. And whenever you look at it or show it to anybody, you must let it remind you to be a good little girl. Whenever you are naughty and somebody points to that mark, which your good old Santa Claus boot made on the marble, what will you say, little sweetheart? Goodbye for a few minutes till I come down and ring the kitchen doorbell. Your loving Santa Claus, whom people sometimes call the Man in the Moon. I'm going to end today with a poem by Phyllis McGinley, Christmas Eve in Our Village. Main Street is gay. Each lamppost glimmers, crowned with a blue electric star. The gift tree by our fountain shimmers, superbly tall, if angular, donated by the men's bazaar. With garlands proper to the times, our doors are wreathed, our lintels strewn. From our two steeples sound the chimes, incessant, through the afternoon. Only a little out of tune. Breathless, with boxes hard to handle, the grocery drivers come and go. Madam the chairman lights a candle to introduce our club's tableau. The hopeful children pray for snow. They cluster, mittened, in the park to talk of morning. Half affrighted and early comes the winter dark. And early are our windows lighted to beckon homeward the benighted. The eggnogs lifted for libation, silent at last the postman's ring. But on the plaza near the station, the carolers are caroling. O little town, they sing. I've reached the end of our reading for today. If you know someone who could use our service, or if you're interested in volunteering or donating to our nonprofit to keep us on the air, it is tax deductible. Please call 508-539-2030 or visit our website, audibleloculledger.org. You can now listen to us on Alexa-powered speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot. Just say these exact words: Alexa, play the radio station Audible Local Ledger on TuneIn, and you'll have a clear, static-free connection to our readings. As always, thank you for your continued support. Bye for now.